This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with author and activist Norman Solomon about his new book, War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine.
As Norman documents, at least 364,000 people have been killed in the last two decades by America's invisible wars.
We'll also speak with Sandra Tamari, the Palestinian-American activist, on what's been happening in the refugee camp in Jenin.
Armed by the United States, the Israeli military has used helicopters, drones, and bulldozers to level the refugee camp in Jenin. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
From Afghanistan to Iraq and Syria and on to little-known deployments in a range of countries worldwide, the United States has been at perpetual war for at least the past two decades. Yet many of these foreign wars remain off the radar of average Americans. We speak today with author and political analyst Norman Solomon about his new book, War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Solomon writes that since the attacks on 9/11, more than 20 years ago, first in the war in Afghanistan and then in Iraq, a huge consequential shift in American foreign policy was set in motion, a perpetual state of war that is almost entirely invisible to the public. Solomon exposes how this happened and what the consequences are for military and civilian casualties and for the draining of resources here at home. Compliant journalists add to the smokescreen by providing narrow coverage of military engagements and by repeating the military's talking points. Meanwhile, the increased use of high technology, air power, and remote drones has put distance between soldiers and the civilians killed in action. Back home, Solomon shows the cloak of invisibility masks massive Pentagon budgets and receives bipartisan support, even as housing, medical care, education, and infrastructure goes begging. Norman Solomon is co-founder of RootsAction.org and the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's written many books, but War Made Invisible is his first one in 15 years.
Norman Solomon, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot.
Can you talk about the colossal U.S. military machine and its massive and negative effects on people around the world? You assert that frequent killing of civilians, upwards of 364,000 over the past two decades, has been a predictable, even inevitable, result of U.S. government policy priorities. How so?
The numbers are important, while we also should recognize and remember that these are real people and have loved ones, and this is a reality of war. And in the case of the so-called war on terror, the numbers of about 360,000 are those directly killed by the U.S. wars in the last 20 years. And that doesn't include indirectly. So the destruction of infrastructure, healthcare, housing, sanitation. Several times as many have died indirectly from the U.S. wars. And these numbers come from the Cost of War Project at Brown University, rarely seen or discussed in U.S. mass media.
Norman Solomon, your book is called War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. You said that you chose the title of your book first, even before you wrote it. What was it in the book that caused you to reverse the usual process?
As it turned out, War Made Invisible is the first book I've written in 15 years. And I have been organizing and writing hundreds of articles in the meantime. And I really wanted to have a good reason to write a new book. And what gradually occurred to me is that what is hidden in plain sight is extremely powerful in our culture, our politics, and media. And I try to come to terms with what has changed since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And the title War Made Invisible came to me because the more these wars continue and become part of the echo chamber, the media routine, the less we're aware of it. The U.S. constantly, endlessly at war, and yet it sort of blends into the scenery, the sort of, in a media standpoint, a sort of a dog bites human story. It just rarely rises to the level of people thinking about it, let alone talking about it. So War Made Invisible became the title and the first words I wrote of the book, really, because the less we know about, the less we see these wars, really the more insidious they become.
Talk about the complicity of the major news media outlets, especially over the last 20 years, in their coverage of the war in Afghanistan and then Iraq, which were undertaken by the United States.
In a country that has important elements of democracy like the U.S., the involvement of the public in at least passively accepting a war is absolutely crucial. And so to give an example of how powerful the U.S. news media really are, right after 9/11, as it became clear that the United States was about to launch an attack on Afghanistan, a country that provided none of the 19 hijackers on 9/11, Gallup did a poll and found that 90% of the public supported the impending invasion, 5% were unsure, and only 5% were opposed. Well, that's a result of the messaging from people in power in Washington and news media. When you have only 1 out of 20 people in the country opposed to the U.S. attacking a nation that had nothing to do with the 9/11 tragedy, then it's really a barometer of how powerful the de facto propaganda system for war is in the United States. And from that day to this, major news media, with occasional exceptions, really provide a worldview, what we might call a window on the world tinted red, white, and blue, that justifies the assumptions of what Dr. Martin Luther King called the madness of militarism, that the United States has the prerogative to intervene militarily, to work its will on the world as best it can pull it off.
In my lifetime, over the last 80 years, I was born at the beginning of World War II, with one exception, the decade after the Vietnam War ended in 1975. The United States has been at war continually. Do you see a qualitative difference in the last 20 years in war being made more invisible? At the end of the Gulf War in 1991, President George H. Bush said, "By God, we've kicked the Vietnam Syndrome once and for all." What was the Vietnam Syndrome, and why was it an important concept?
Well, if we really contrast the, say, media coverage of the Vietnam War or the Gulf War of 1991 or the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in this century, there was some visibility in TV and media. I'm not saying it conveyed the horrors of war. It did not. But at least it made people conscious that the wars were going on, that in their names, with their tax dollars, the U.S. was bombing and strafing and having mobilization of troops and deployment and engagement in battle. That has really changed in the last number of years as the 21st century has unfolded. And so, as you mentioned, when the first President Bush rejoiced and said, "We've kicked the Vietnam Syndrome once and for all," in 1991, he was alluding to what he and the military establishment, the political elites, saw as the negative that they called the Vietnam Syndrome beginning to fade away. And by Vietnam Syndrome, they meant the attitude that the United States shouldn't just go around the world and try to use its military might to get its way, because people, so many people, decided that the Vietnam War was wrong. So it all boils down to that those in the military-industrial complex, to use the phrase from Dwight Eisenhower, were really gung-ho to reassert the prerogative of the U.S. to wage war and to go ahead and do it.
Norman Solomon, in the early fall of 2021, President Biden declared during a speech at the United Nations that the U.S. had, quote, turned the page, end quote, and was not at war for the first time in 20 years. How true was that claim?
One of the things that I'm able to do in this book, War Made Invisible, is encompass the opening and the military strategies and policies of the Biden administration. And I could note that, you know, I'm very opposed to the Republicans, the neo-fascist GOP. And after supporting Bernie Sanders in 2016 and 2020, when it was between Biden and Trump, I worked for and advocated for in swing states, people should vote for Biden against the neo-fascist Republican Party. That said, when President Biden in the last couple of years in his administration now has claimed, as he did at the UN almost 2 years ago, that the United States is no longer at war, it was a lie then, and it's a lie now. The U.S. has 1,000 troops in Syria as we speak. It's bombing with drone and military rocket strikes in Somalia. It is engaged in special ops around the country, much of which we don't know about, although we know the special operations budget continues to go through the roof. The overall military budget continues to expand enormously. The United States is engaged in supporting what is now a seven-year war on Yemen, led by Saudi Arabia, which is an autocracy, the oil sheikdom, and people will remember exactly a year ago, President Biden gave a fist bump to the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia while the slaughter continued with U.S. help of people in Yemen. Right now, the estimate is close to 400,000 human beings in Yemen have been killed thanks to the Saudi-led and U.S.-supported war there. So the United States is at war, and it brings me back again to the crucial aspect of visibility, that I call the book War Made Invisible because until we can recognize what the heck is going on, we can't address it. As a matter of fact, in the book, I quote James Baldwin, who says, and I think this is so true, just because we face something, it doesn't mean we can change it, but we will never be able to change it unless we first face it.
We're talking with Norman Solomon, who's just had his very fine book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Norman, Cornel West supported Obama, but he has since changed his mind and become an independent candidate for president. How do you feel about his candidacy?
I love Cornel West. At RootsAction.org, where I work, we have done joint efforts with him. I was at a news conference with him, supporting CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling. I agree with everything Cornel West is saying now, except his strategy of running as a third-party candidate, evidently on the ballot, as is planned anyway, for the Green Party. The fact is we have a neo-fascist threat, and we have a structure of elections in this country, unlike Europe, which has parliamentary system, where if we have our feet on the ground in the real world, it's going to be a Democrat or Republican who occupies the Oval Office come 2025. And so I think it's simply a practical matter. We need to fight against the militarists of both parties. There's very little difference between the Democratic and Republican parties in foreign policy. But when you get to domestic policy, reproductive rights, racism, immigration, so many different ways, the entire tenor of the white supremacist approach of the modern Republican Party, to conflate the two and say that it doesn't matter who wins, I think is a mistake. And even Cornell in recent years has said, and I think he's quite correct, that the Republican Party is neo-fascist and the Democratic Party is neoliberal. And we need to oppose both, given the predatory nature of corporate capitalism that neoliberalism represents. At the same time, there are women, people of color, the poor, so many different aspects of democracy in peril that require that we defeat Republicans.
Well, speaking of the two-party system, who owns the major news media and what's the relationship to the Republican and Democratic parties? And for that matter, what's the relationship to the arms industry and even to Hollywood?
Very important. These are all intermeshed. We have the revolving door between members of Congress and administrations and military contractors. And keep in mind, I don't call it defense contractors because little of this really has to do with genuine defense. You have people in the Pentagon who rotate through. They appear on news outlets, often not even acknowledged to have been former military officials or especially being present or former members of the boards of large military contracting corporations. And then we have the news media, which also is part of a revolving door. We notoriously had Henry Kissinger on a huge media board of directors after he oversaw crimes against people in Southeast Asia. Here we are in 2023, major corporations with dominant control of television, of big media outlets in the United States, Fox Corporation, Disney, Comcast, Warner Brothers, Discovery, Paramount Global. These are huge conglomerates, and they are part of what we might call a superstructure that dominates us. And I have to remember here to mention that Martin Luther King Jr. not only condemned what he called the madness of militarism, but he also described runaway military spending, and I'm quoting here, as a demonic suction tube. It's a demonic suction tube now as it was in 1967 when he spoke those words. Education, healthcare, housing, neonatal care, infant care, elderly care, environmental protection, so many aspects of life that are suffering grievously in the United States right now through lack of funding, of support. Meanwhile, tremendous amounts of money going to the military, to the militarism of the United States, 750 military bases overseas. This is what we're dealing with. This is what we need to challenge.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here on Law and Disorder with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall. We're speaking with author Norman Solomon about his new book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Norman, cluster bombs have been outlawed by a treaty signed by 120 countries. The United States, Russia, and Ukraine did not sign the treaty, but Biden agreed to sell cluster bombs to the Ukraine. What's a cluster bomb? What was its effect when it was used in Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam? And how did the major media cover the story? I remember reading just the other day that they used the word bomblet and duds, language designed to reduce the horrific impact of what these bombs do. Please talk about this.
This has come up in the news a lot in the last few days. I spent a lot of time and devoted several pages of my book, War Made Invisible, to the subject of cluster munitions. It has a long and horrible history. They are basically, you might say, flying landmines. They are powerful lateral weapons who move that when they explode, go in all directions. And as you allude to, even though it's a sort of a pleasant sounding word almost, the bomblets are submunitions inside the major cluster munition, and thousands of them move in all directions, and they're basically exploding shrapnel. And they're among the most horrific weapons of modern warfare, which is saying something. And the effects, when we go back earlier incarnations of them in Laos and Vietnam, people are still dying from these unexploded ordnances, the fact that children often pick them up if they find them in the grass, in the ground, in a riverbed, which means that they're often attracted to picking them up. They look like little toys. And as I talk about in the book, we've had experiences where the United States used those weapons, cluster bombs in that case, dropped from on high in the bombing of Kosovo and Yugoslavia in 1999. It was horrific. It shredded people going to the marketplace to buy vegetables. Very little negative coverage in U.S. media at the time. When the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, it used, and this is according to the Congressional Research Service, it used 1.8 to 2 million so-called bomblets, cluster munition, in that attack. And the result was, of course, tremendous human suffering, and people still are stumbling across, picking up what is left of the so-called the duds that are used and don't always go off. You know, there's been media coverage disputes between the Biden White House and some researchers. What is the dud rate? In other words, weapons that are fired, cluster munitions, but they don't go off and then they later go off. And the White House says, oh, it's just 1 or 2%. Other researchers say 15 or 20 or more percent. That's just one aspect. Of course, you don't want to have these duds lying in waiting to explode later on. But at the time that they're dropped, they're also slaughtering people, not only military people, but civilians. What's really notable, and this is the kind of doublethink that it's another form of really war made invisible, and that is that we have these doublethink processes where, as George Orwell outlined in 1984, information and assessments can be put on the shelf, they're taken off the shelf and used for propaganda, and then when they're no longer convenient, when they become inconvenient truths, they're put back on the shelf. And this is a case in point. Again, when I thought about what is the through line or theme of this book, the title War Made Easy, War Made Invisible in this case, War Made Invisible, came to mind because we have this very hard to see but very pervasive propaganda system that is based on duplicity. And this is a case in point where 18 months ago, when Russian forces, and we should condemn this invasion and war on Ukraine by Russia, when Russian forces attacked Ukraine, they began to use cluster munitions. And the response from the Biden White House was, these are war crimes, that cluster munitions are in the category of war crimes. Fast forward 18 months, and in recent days, we're told by the apologists for the Biden administration and the White House itself, and by President Biden, that it's no big deal, that it's a 180, and when the U.S. supplies huge numbers of cluster munitions to its ally in Ukraine, that that's A-OK. And one thing I'd add here is that the rationale is very important, because the reason why the U.S. is now claiming at the top of its government that it's OK to ship these cluster munitions to Ukraine is that Ukraine is running out of weaponry, and the U.S. can't keep up with its production, and the NATO countries are not able to supply sufficiently, resupply weaponry and bombs and so forth. And so the United States has waiting on its shelf many cluster munitions, an overabundance. And why leave them there? Why not put them to use? There's a crying need for them. And so that's the rationale, that to defeat Russians, even though we said that it was a crime against humanity, now we're going to supply cluster munitions. And one more thing I would add on that point. The same rationale being used now to send cluster munitions to Ukraine is also the rationale in the military strategic doctrine of the United States and Russia, that if conventional forces are up against the wall, the government reserves the right to be the first to use nuclear weapons in the conflict. It's the same rationale. If we feel and we're fearful that we're losing a war in a conflict, then it's okay to do a 180 and contradict all of our moral pronouncements and introduce our cluster munitions into the conflict. It's the same part of the doctrine. It's the same rationale that says, if we're in a conventional war in Europe or anywhere else, and we are afraid of losing, we reserve the right to be the first to use nuclear weapons in that conflict.
Norman Solomon, is there a favorite passage in your book, War Made Invisible? How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, that you could read for us?
Here's a short section that's in the introduction, and it's really a kind of thematic through line and ultimately a motivation for reading the book. I feel that this is a political and psychological aspect of the warfare state of the United States and the social and political culture that we live in that has not been named really and talked about openly, and yet it's so important. So here's a little section from my book, War Made Invisible. The politicizing of grief exploded in the wake of 9/11. While indescribable pain, rage, and fear set the U.S. cauldron to boil, national leaders promised their alchemy would bring unalloyed security. The gold standard included pursuing a global war effort that promised to be unceasing. America's dead and bereaved were vastly and appropriately important. In contrast, the deaths and bereavements of equally innocent people due to U.S. military actions overseas were devalued to such an extent that domestic politics perpetuated two tiers of grief, momentous and close to meaningless, ours and theirs. The understood boundaries required the leaders of both major political parties to keep affirming and reinforcing the tiers of grief as a kind of zero-sum template. American suffering loomed so large that there wasn't much room to see or care about the suffering of others, even if, or especially if, it was caused by the United States.
Thank you, Norman. That was very powerful. Your book, War Made Invisible, has received a lot of praise. It's been published by the New Press. I just wanted to read one sentence that Daniel Ellsberg had to say about the book. No one is better at exposing the dynamics of media and politics that keep starting and continuing wars. War Made Invisible will provide the fresh and profound clarity that our country desperately needs. That was Daniel Ellsberg, who recently passed away. Norman, might you please tell us about the organization you co-founded called Roots Action, and also the Institute for Public Advocacy, which you direct?
Well, I'm really very glad to be, and I like being a writer, a columnist, an author. And at the same time, I feel that what is absolutely most crucial and frankly the most difficult is organizing. We have people around the United States and elsewhere in the world who are doing the very difficult, sometimes frankly tedious work of organizing from the grassroots, of realizing that everything we have to be proud of in terms of public policy and government programs is the result not of what's handed down from on high, but is struggled for, is made possible, is achieved by people who organize in their communities and across racial and geographic and other boundaries. And so that's a reason why I was very proud to co-found RootsAction.org about a dozen years ago, and also the Institute for Public Accuracy, which has been around for more than 20 years. The Institute is really an ongoing effort. We're online at accuracy.org to provide sources that are usually overlooked by all sorts of media, especially corporate media, and to serve as a sort of repository and access point. We have thousands of activists, researchers, academics, experts who are in our database, and we offer them when there's breaking news or long-term problems to be assessed and solutions to be proposed. So that's what we do day to day at the Institute for Public Accuracy. Meanwhile, at RootsAction.org, we're into action, as the name conveys. We're multi-issue. We're independent of all political parties. We invite people to sign up for our action alerts at RootsAction.org, and we really challenge the dominance of corporations and the military-industrial complex, and we aim to do that every day.
Norman Solomon, we've come to an end of our allotted time. You've written an important book, War Made Invisible. We hope that listeners will get out there and get the book, spread the word. And Norman, we truly appreciate your being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate being on with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On the 4th of July, as we in the U.S. heard fireworks and firecrackers, people in the Palestinian city of Jenin heard real gunfire and felt real explosions. The day before, 1,000 Israeli soldiers descended on the city with helicopters, drones, and bulldozers, beginning a two-day bombardment that leveled the city, reduced its buildings to rubble, damaged hospitals, knocked out utilities, and left at least 13 people dead, including 12 Palestinians and one Israeli soldier. At least 100 were wounded, and thousands of people, about 80% of those living in the refugee camp, were left without shelter, water, and electricity. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, immediately condemned Israel's use of excessive force against civilians. He has refused to retract his statement, even under enormous pressure from Israel's UN ambassador, who called Mr. Guterres's criticism, quote, shameful, far-fetched, and completely detached from reality. A handful of Arab countries and a European Union envoy have also criticized Israel. But other countries, like the U.S.? Well, let's say the silence of the U.S. speaks volumes. To give us more insight and background about what's happening in Israel and Palestine, we're so fortunate to have with us Sandra Tamari. Sandra holds a master's degree in Arab studies from Georgetown University. She's a Palestinian organizer and also the executive director of the Adala Justice Project, a Palestinian advocacy organization that builds toward collective liberation through labor, cultural, and legislative campaigns. Sandra Tamari, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Maria.
Sandra, can you start by telling us a little more about the history of Jenin and its historical significance?
Yes, the Jenin refugee camp is located in the city of Jenin. It's the most northern refugee camp based in the West Bank, and it houses Palestinian refugees who were displaced from their homes in 1948 during the Nakba, or the origins of the Israeli state. Most of the people that live in Jenin refugee camp come from places around Haifa and the mountains near there, relatively close, you know, to where Jenin is located. It's only an hour drive between Haifa and the Jenin refugee camp. It houses about 12,000 residents. Some estimates put it a little bit higher, but it's important to note that the whole camp is a half square kilometer. It's a very tight space. And it's been an area of incredible resistance to continued land theft on the part of the Israeli regime. And in 2002, Israeli forces entered the camp in something known as the Battle of Jenin. They were there for 11 days and destroyed the entire camp. So the latest attack last week is not the first time that this camp has been under attack. And most recently, people will remember that the beloved and famed journalist for Al Jazeera, Shireen Abu Akleh, was murdered in Jenin camp in May 2022. So it's been a place of incredible symbolism and resistance for Palestinians.
Sandra, why did the Israelis decide to strike Jenin at this point in time?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, Jenin has always been a symbol of resistance. And most recently, the focus of the Israeli regime has been on Nablus, on resistance in the city of Nablus. Because Nablus is so closely located to large colonial settlements, many, many settlers are around Nablus. So the Israeli regime focused on Nablus to, eliminate resistance against these settlers. Jenin was a little bit further afield, so now the attention has turned to wiping out resistance in Jenin. I don't think that this latest incursion has wiped it out. The threat, the resistance is not going away, as we know that Jenin's, for decades has been fighting against, the theft of their land and the really terrible conditions within the camp. As I said, it's a very densely populated place. Unemployment is very high, and even before this latest military incursion, infrastructure was very weak. It's a place that the Israelis have focused on because Jenin's, resistance has been successful despite all of these attacks and despite this terrible economic situation, because it's a tight-knit society. The organizational relationships that exist in the camp have allowed them to avoid internal conflict. It's helped them to shield their resistance from interventions from groups such as the Palestinian Authority, that is basically coordinating with Israeli security forces. So they haven't been as vulnerable to things like rumors and distrust and enticing resistance fighters away from resistance. They've been really, really strong in the face of all kinds of Israeli and Palestinian Authority efforts to limit their activity. So Israel has turned to this military force to try to dampen this really strong social network.
Well, Sandra Tamari, what's currently happening there on the ground then in Jenin after these attacks? Are the Israeli soldiers gone? And are there safe places where people can access shelter, food, and water?
Well, the devastation was huge. The Israelis took up road infrastructure, water pipelines, electricity networks to the camp, and destroyed about 80% of the housing in the camp in 2 days. The soldiers are gone for now, but there's no guarantee that they won't be back. They can be back at any time in a flash. So there is obviously high anxiety about that. And food and water are being provided by Palestinians from neighboring villages and towns. An incredible show of solidarity with the residents of Jenin, and the cleanup is underway. So people are rebuilding at a time, just a very terrible and desperate time. Everyone is feeling very traumatized. Analysts have said that the Israeli operation was meant to make Jenin unlivable. It is that, but the residents of Jenin have said that they will go nowhere else. They will stay in the camp and they will re rebuild.
So, what countries and organizations have come to the aid of the Palestinians in Jenin?
Well, after military destruction like this, there's always an outpouring of aid, and I think it's important to understand, like, how is this money being channeled and who is in control of it? In the case of Jenin, already we're seeing millions of dollars come from Arab states such as Algeria and the United Arab Emirates. But all of this money is being administered by the Palestinian Authority. I think it's important to give some context about the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority was established in 1993 after Israel and the Palestinians signed the Oslo Accords. The Palestinian Authority has, for a very long time now, been seen by Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza and in the diaspora as a subcontractor of the Israeli government. They are coordinating on security. They are doing everything they can to put down Palestinian resistance, to settler violence to further land grabs by the Israeli regime. And so having this money come through the Palestinian Authority really means that it's an attempt at pacification of Jenin. These pledges will come, and it'll be the PA that's in charge of a lot of wealth. And there's no way that the residents of Jenin can turn this down, and they shouldn't. They have to rebuild their lives. But it's important to remember, you know, it's all, you know, after the there were 12 people killed during these 2 days inside Jenin, and a PA delegation came to Jenin to the funerals, and they were forced out. They were not allowed to attend the funerals. So there's a lot of anger at the Palestinian Authority's inaction, how they did not come to protect the residents of the camp. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this aid is administered and how it's used to try to, you know, rein in the resistance. The resistance is going to have to make some choices about, you know, who they will fight. You know, how much can they withstand? They're up against a very powerful Israeli military that wants their destruction. Are they willing to challenge the Palestinian Authority? No one is quite sure what will happen next.
Well, Sandra Tamari, in the introduction, I mentioned the U.S. has stayed silent on the matter, neither condemning nor defending Israel's attack on Jenin. Is that still good information? Is that your understanding as well? And if so, what does Biden fear would happen if he were to criticize Israel?
Yeah, that is my understanding, that the U.S. has made no statement about Israel's attacks on Jenin. These attacks are clearly a war crime. They are attacks on civilian populations. They are attacks against a legal resistance against occupation. These are laws laid out, as you all know here on this show, by international humanitarian law. But they're not being upheld by the U.S. in any way in this instance. Does Biden fear speaking out or criticizing Israel? I don't see it that way. I think that the Biden administration simply does not care about the fate of Palestinian refugees. And that's always been the case. I don't think that they don't have a stake in seeing that Israel is held accountable for these war crimes. Indeed, you know, they are the state that is that's enabling all of this. They are providing the weapons, the military funding, and the political backing that allows Israel to continue to perpetrate these war crimes without any kind of consequences.
Why is it that the United States supports Israel in the fashion that it does? Because many of us believe that, but for American support, Israel couldn't do what it's doing.
Well, I think that it's a question that goes deeper than a lot of people will say. Some people will say that it's all about political interest and about elections and funding. But I think that it goes back a little bit further. You know, often you'll hear U.S. leaders say that, you know, they support Israel as a democracy, or they support Israel because they share our values. And obviously, sharing our values is meant in a way to say that, you know, it's a liberal democracy. But the reality is we do share values in that we believe in taking land from native people, and that we believe that our political might and our military might should rule the region. Israel is a very important, you know, colonial outpost of the U.S. and has been for some time. And so Israel exists in a space where, you know, in a region where the U.S. Has lots and lots of interest and can keep, you know, Israel has becomes, you know, the military and becomes the political power that can balance all of that for the U.S. That might not always be the case. We do see signs. China and Russia are playing more of a role in the region, not always with good impact. They're all of these actors are imperial powers, but the U.S. right now plays a really, really devastating impact, has a devastating impact on the region, and Israel is just one of the tools that it uses.
This is Attorney Michael Smith here on Law and Disorder. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall, and we're speaking with Sandra Tamari of the Adala Justice Project on the recent events in Jenin, the occupied city in the West Bank of Israel. Sandra, can you tell us a little more about Benjamin Netanyahu, who was re-elected for a fifth term as Prime Minister of Israel last November? How do you see his attacks on Jenin fitting into his overall political strategy, and what does it foretell for the future?
Yeah, Benjamin Netanyahu is elected as the leader of the ruling coalition again in the fall. And he's the longest serving prime minister of Israel in its existence. He's always been a right-wing figure and always been someone that has been, well, I would say every Israeli leader has been one that has not been taken an interest in the well-being of the Palestinian people. Every single leader of Israel has been one that has sought to expand Israel's geographic control and to create sovereignty for the Israeli state over an area that has as much land as possible for as few Palestinians as possible. Netanyahu is in a strange agreement right now. He formed his coalition with extremist settlers, people that actually live on the West Bank and are engaged in violence against Palestinians, have militias that are shooting at Palestinians on roads and driving people out of their homes. Part of his coalition lives in places like Hebron and are openly calling for people to carry arms and to shoot Palestinians. And so the number of settlers, Israeli settlers, that have moved into the West Bank since 2002, since Jenin was attacked the first time, has doubled. So we're talking about 500,000 people, not even talking about the settlements around Jerusalem, in the West Bank, in the far reaches of the West Bank, living there with roads that are made exclusively for them, with infrastructure made exclusively for them, Palestinians being kicked off this land to make way for those settlers, and people being squeezed, you know, Palestinians being squeezed tighter and tighter into smaller areas. And Netanyahu is, he's on the beck and call of these right-wing settlers within his government. So people like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich are the ones calling the shots. So, you know, the attack on Jenin was largely done by this government in reaction to those right-wing settlers within the coalition who said that they wanted to snuff out all Palestinian resistance and ensure that these Israeli settlers continue to have free reign on the land.
Sandra Tamari, can you tell us a little bit about the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, otherwise known as BDS? What is it, and what kind of backlash do proponents face, even here in the U.S.?
Yeah, so Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions is a Palestinian call. It was endorsed by the vast majority of civil society within Palestine, calling on the international community to engage in campaigns that boycott and divest from and sanction Israel until it complies with international law. Very clear demands about giving, you know, the land back, ending the occupation, and providing a way for Palestinian refugees to return to their homes, not to make this only about, obviously, only about the occupation, but to provide justice and equality for Palestinians that live within the state of Israel, have citizenship, but are treated worse than second-class citizens. So, you know, they're asking for this, these points of equality, freedom, and justice through campaigns such as a campaign that my organization is working on to ask the state of New York to end the designation of as charities, some of these organizations that are directly funding the settlements. So there are several charities that are registered in New York where people can give donations that directly go to the the Israeli treasury to fund expanded settlement activity. And they can get a tax deduction for those contributions. So these are the kinds of, you know, this is an example of a BDS campaign. We're also engaged in, people are engaged in cultural boycott campaigns, asking artists to not play in Israel, similar to campaigns, cultural campaigns that were directed against South African apartheid. The idea being that we really want to make sure that people understand that Israel is not a normal state. It's a state that is built on the ethnic cleansing of an entire people, and it's ongoing. That's what the BDS movement is working toward, helping people understand that and to put a lot of pressure on the international community to hold Israel accountable. It's a very, you know, these are very simple tactics, and they're tactics that have gone back, you know, for decades, used by different civil rights movements. But the backlash that Palestinians have faced and the BDS movement has faced have been huge. Any criticism of Israel is seen as a threat by the Israeli government and by the U.S. state. And so you see a variety of laws passed at the state level that have made it illegal for state contractors, for instance, to be engaged by the state if they endorse a boycott of Israel. These are being challenged. These laws are being challenged, but for the moment they stand in many states. And obviously, you know, the kinds of attacks that activists face, you know, doxing, internet attacks, and physical attacks, are happening, and people, you know, the whole idea is just to shut down, you know, the debate and to discourage people from being active in our movement. And I think that what our movement has been able to do is to show that there's a very strong infrastructure that's going to protect activists who get involved. And that if you are someone who is attacked or accused of anti-Semitism or doxxed or taken to court over any kind of activity related to Palestine, you have an amazing group of organizations and a movement that's ready to protect you.
In the light of the challenges that you and others face to defend Palestinian rights, where do you find encouragement?
Well, I find encouragement in many places. I think that here in the U.S., we're seeing a real generational shift. You see all kinds of polling that shows that, you know, at least Democratic voters are increasingly more sympathetic with Palestinians than with Israelis. There was a recent Gallup poll that showed that trend for the first time. You see polls that show that young Jewish Americans are increasingly critical of the state of Israel and are siding with Palestinians, so a growing Jewish anti-Zionist movement. And you see connections, like connections between Black Lives Matter, indigenous struggle, Palestinian struggle, immigrant rights, you know, all of this coming together so that Palestine is really part of a beautiful lattice of left movements, part of a growing sense of what social justice means, and Palestine is not being excluded from that. So I find a lot of encouragement in that, and it makes my work really exciting, especially working with young people. We recently had an amazing organizing win where Sierra Club, an organization that has sided with the Israeli regime and is continuing to take tours, nature tours to apartheid Israel. They insist, they've doubled down on taking those tours despite a lot of grassroots pressure. But their workers just passed a resolution, the union, siding with Palestinians and making commitments, solid commitments to show solidarity with Palestine. So, you know, it's younger workers that have made this stance against a really old and really becoming more and more irrelevant environmental organization.
Sandra Tamari, where can our listeners go to read and learn more about the situation of the Palestinian people in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, there are lots of good sources of information. First of all, I'm going to plug our own organization. Please follow Adala Justice Project on social media and sign up for our newsletter on our website, adalajusticeproject.org, A-D-A-L-A-H, justiceproject.org. And, you know, really good sources of information. You know, there's independent journalism happening at Mondo Weiss, who has a team on the ground in Palestine, and they're doing incredible reporting. So I encourage people to check out Mondo Weiss. And then publications like Middle East Eye, who are doing great reporting and also putting out content on social media every day. If you look at Middle East Eye's history over the last couple of weeks, you get an incredible and very sad documentary depiction of what Palestinians have been dealing with, including the situation in Jenin. And then I would tell people to get involved with organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace and the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and just keep up to date on campaigns that are happening because, you know, obviously knowledge is amazing and good. We want people to stay informed, but we also really, really want the movement to grow. And there are many ways for people to get active in a variety of legislative and cultural and labor campaigns, for instance, related to boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Thank you so much for being our guest today, Sandra Tamari of the Adala Justice Project. On behalf of my co-host, Michael Smith, and myself, Maria Hall, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Keep up the good work, Sandra. Thank you so much for being on our show.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.